Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome once again. We are about to have a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Chris Hedges, who writes for Nation magazine and Truth Dig. He spent 20-odd years as a foreign correspondent covering wars across the globe, as an affluent Arabic speaker, 15 years in the New York Times. He wrote some books that some of you have read, I'm sure, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, Death of a Liberal Class, Empire of Illusion, and just has a new column which I just read in Truth Dig. He writes Mother Jones, New York Review of Books, and many other places. His latest work is The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. And Chris Hedges, welcome. Good to have you on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you.
So I've read most of the works you've done before this. This may be maybe the first or second time, actually, that you've been on the air with us, but not at this length. And I'd like to begin with the beginning of your book and kind of reflecting on your friend who said to you, you're not a journalist, you're a minister, pretending to be a journalist. And in many ways, reading what you write, you do approach things from a deeply moralistic kind of vision, a sense of what you think truth means, and which kind of, for many people in the journalistic world, doesn't sit well in terms of what journalism is supposed to mean to some.
Well, the good journalists care primarily about truth. But truth and news are very different commodities. And one can write a story that's ostensibly balanced and impartial and factually correct, and yet is untrue. I'll give you an example. After the 22-day Israeli bombing and siege of Gaza, the New York Times went in and wrote a story where they interviewed eyewitnesses as to what Israelis had done within their village. And every other paragraph was turned over to an Israeli spokesperson in Jerusalem, who countered each of the accusations that were made by an eyewitness. Now, in the world of American journalism, this was balanced and impartial, and I'm sure in terms of column inches, the Israelis were given the exact same space the eyewitnesses were. But by the end of the article, it allowed readers to believe whatever they wanted to believe. It was a way to obscure truth, not promote truth. And as someone who has worked for the New York Times for 15 years, I know that there were stories that I did, for instance, in the Balkans, where I would go into a village and interview eyewitnesses about Serbian atrocities, and we did not give every other paragraph to Serbian spokespeople out of Belgrade. So one can't fault it in terms of the paradigm of American journalism. And that's when I say that truth and news are not the same thing. And for all of us who care more about truth than we do about news, inevitably we run into problems with news institutions because there are some truths that are deeply unpalatable to the American public. And the mechanism of journalistic objectivity and impartiality becomes a way to obscure, not advance, truth.
Now, I'm going to talk about some of the examples you just gave. You spent a lot of time in the book writing about, Palestine and Israel and the Middle East, and that's very important. I'm glad you did. I want to wander our way through that in a little bit. But when you use the example of the Balkans and what happens in Gaza, and you can fast forward to this moment as we cover Syria, Libya, Bahrain, Egypt, Tunisia, and the way we cover it and how we cover those things are very much akin to the imbalance between covering Bosnia, where our enemy was Serbia, and covering Israel-Palestine, where we, in our media, tend towards supporting Israel. Do you know what I'm saying?
I covered Israel for the New York Times. I know
right.
The game really well.
So what I'm saying is, though, I mean, that is what we do. I mean, it depends on the kind of the vision, the ideas that Americans have or have been given tends to define how we cover an issue across the globe.
Exactly. And look at the kind of coverage that was given to Hosni Mubarak's Egypt before the events in Tahrir Square. I don't think most Americans had any idea how repressive, corrupt, and brutal the Egyptian state was, because Hosni Mubarak is considered an ally. And if you remember in the days leading up to his eventual ouster, the American government refused to stand on the side of those who were calling for transparency and openness and democracy and freedom, but clung to Mubarak until the very last minute and utterly discredited themselves, not only in the eyes of Egyptians, but in the wider world. We support democracy when it's politically convenient, and we cover up for war criminals and dictators and despots when it serves our interests. Now, this isn't anything new, but the American press, unfortunately, collaborates in all of this.
What do you mean? Define, when you you worked in the New York Times for 15 years, so what do you mean by collaborate? What does that word mean? It's a very provocative term. What does it mean that the press collaborates from your perspective?
Well, when you challenge the official narrative of Washington, you run into the buzzsaw of the power, not only the power elite, but the Washington press corps. And as any good foreign correspondent will tell you, they not only struggle with the power brokers in Washington, but the power brokers within their own news bureau in Washington. Because when you are a reporter in Washington, it's all about access. And once that access dries up, you're finished, with a very few exceptions, like Cy Hirsch and others who do great investigative work. But most reporters in a Washington bureau, especially in a place like the New York Times, get there because they're very good at doing lunch. They socialize with these people, they hang out with these people, and the version of reality that is peddled by the power elite is one that they put into the paper. The perfect example of this is what happened in the buildup to the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
Where the New York Times, because it had access to the White House, Lewis Scooter Libby and Cheney's office, published lie after lie after lie after lie. I mean, it became almost farcical because ostensibly classified information about, aluminum rods being used for proposed nuclear facilities were being bought in Niger. I mean, all of it was fabricated. But it comes out on the front page of the New York Times, and then Cheney and other administration officials position themselves on the Monday morning talk shows, are asked about the story, which they've leaked, and then they confirm it. And so this penchant for access, this belief that somehow, and this is especially the Achilles heel of the New York Times, the most important thing is being part of a player within the circles of power, has allowed much of the media, and including the Times, and I don't want to trash the Times, the paper I still read every day, just to be spun. So they not only become used in terms of propagating a war based on false information, but they completely missed the financial meltdown, because instead of going into low-income neighborhoods where people are being given subprime mortgages that bankers and mortgage brokers know can never be repaid, they're running down and having lunch with Robert Rubin at Citibank or Lawrence Summers or someone else. And again, they completely missed the collapse of the global economy. I mean, not a small story, $40 trillion in wealth that was evaporated. So there's a real problem within the American press. Television has been completely corrupted and destroyed. And newspapers, as they watch advertisers leave, as their profits continue to decline, their news pages continue to shrink, their news staff increasingly are downsized, have become even more craven in their service to corporate forces, because because they're running scared. So the problem's actually gotten worse, not better.
What you're saying makes me reflect on something that happened, I guess, 12 years ago, maybe more, during the Bush administration. You were still at the New York Times then, is that right?
During the Bush administration?
Right,
yes.
During the war. And I had this conversation with a very influential journalist and host from the National Public Radio, because I've been an NPR in and around it for the last 18 years. And we had this huge debate, and it was really, I'm curious what you think about this, because to me it's emblematic of the issue you're talking about. I said something about Dick Cheney being an immoral human being and how he conducted himself and this war that we were going. And the NPR person said to me, I know Dick Cheney, and Dick Cheney's an honorable man. And my response was something like, well, so was Himmler. And his response was, well, we have dinner with him. We know who he is. And what by that he meant was that Dick Cheney used to have these lavish dinners with expensive wine and good food for a lot of the D.C. press corps during that whole period of time. And I think a lot of our fellows in the business, because of those relationships, become compromised by those relationships.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's why, you know, spend 15 years in the Washington Bureau and you begin to look like the very people you're covering. They're completely corrupted. And very, very few people are able to hold out. These people are not our friends. We should not socialize with them. We should not have any contact with them. That the job of a journalist is to watch these people and monitor them on behalf of the citizenry. But the seduction of power is insidious, and you can see it. People who like to be White House correspondents, I mean, what do they get? They, in real time, they get every word the president utters. It's all printed. They don't even have to take notes. But every once in a while they're stroked, and the president knows their name. They're hedonists of power, and that has been a problem within the Washington Press Corps, which has long predated the current era.
So it's all through your writing. I mean, how do you define this issue of morality and what it means to what morality means in the context of our politics and our journalism and especially as you use the word a great deal, truth, of finding truth, and how you even define what that truth means. Who defines that? How does it get defined?
Well, you know, I spent enough time in seminary and studying philosophy to understand the argument that absolute truth doesn't exist.
Right.
But there are things that are true and things that are untrue. And there are certain truths that are not allowed to be uttered within the wider society. For instance, the death and suffering that we have visited on hundreds of thousands of Iraqis since the invasion is something that is rendered invisible. Internal colonies within the United States, the desperate poor, and I just came back a couple of days ago from Pine Ridge, South Dakota.
I know it well.
Yeah, one of the poorest pockets in the United States, 80% unemployment. These people are invisible. We don't see them. The press entertains us with the latest celebrity meltdown, whether it's Charlie Sheen or Wiener. I mean, I can hardly keep up with it. It's all gossip. It's all garbage. And that's exactly what the corporate forces that at this point control the press want. What's frightening to me is that we have roughly a half dozen corporations, Viacom, General Electric, Disney, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, that control just about everything some 90% of Americans see, watch, read, or hear. And they impose this bland uniformity of opinion, as Dorothy Parker said, which ranges from A to B. These celebrity pundits masquerading as journalists on television are entertainers. They are paid these sums of money. A figure like Katie Couric makes $15 million, not for their news ability, she doesn't have any, but their ability to project a kind of empathy, that kind of feel your pain language that politicians like Bill Clinton mastered, even as they were thrusting a knife into the back of working men and women. And these pundits are very much, they're courtiers. They function as courtiers. And they themselves are part of the power elite. I mean, you see them all invited to official White House dinners and associating. So it's this insidious system whereby the voices of citizens are not heard and the needs and rights of citizens are never addressed. And it's always been a problem within American journalism. I mean, the first newspapers at the turn of the century weren't any better. But at least at one point, we had a kind of diversity within the press that had not completely shut these voices out. Now that diversity is gone. There's, you know, a few holdouts, community radios here and there, a couple NPR shows, but not much. I mean, certainly on the commercial media, it's completely vanished.
So I'm very curious at this, and I will get to the point of some of the things you in your book and all your columns and the latest column I read. But I was reading the piece in your book that where you spent time with Sheldon Mollen, a political philosopher, and he in that part of the book, in the very early on in the book, he talks about how different it was in the 30s in terms of the range of different approaches that America could grapple with. But it was clear that even though people like Franklin Delano Roosevelt and others instituted very progressive measures and entered a period of sort of progressivism in America for the next 30 or 40 years, FDR and all the rest, not unlike President Barack Obama or George Bush, were still all kind of tied to the corporate power of America, which is as it has been the 1880s and beyond. So what was so different then than now? What has changed?
Well, it is different, although you make a good point. And when Conrad Black wrote his biography of Roosevelt, he said that in the end, Roosevelt's greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism.
Right.
And Black is right. But the liberal class, and I spend a lot of time talking
you
about
do.
This in my book.
Not very fondly.
Class. The liberal class is important within a capitalist democracy because it functions as a kind of safety valve. It makes incremental and piecemeal reform possible so that when you have, as we did in the 1930s, the breakdown of capitalism, there are figures within the liberal establishment, like Roosevelt, like his vice president, Henry Wallace, who can address, can hear this suffering, and use formal mechanisms of power to redress these injustices and these grievances, which is how we get the New Deal. That's how the liberal class traditionally works. The problem is that all of the radical popular movements that once kept the liberal class honest have been destroyed. The anarchists, the socialists, even the Communist Party, and we whitewash history to forget that integration and sit-down strikes, all of this predated the civil rights movement. This was being done by communists back in the 30s. There was a broad kind of social vision, the eight-hour workday, insurance, pension plans, worker safety. All this stuff came out of unions that had not been reduced, as they are today, to sort of collective bargaining, but had a vision of what a life could be for a worker and their family. So there was an assault beginning in World War I under Wilson and then followed up with the Palmer Raids. But really the kind of death blow came after World War II with McCarthyism and the House Un-American Affairs activity, where you had thousands of people pushed out of universities, high schools, social workers, journalists like I.F. Stone becomes a pariah, government officials, and unions. They're all broken. And internally, these liberal institutions are disemboweled in that kind of constant search for those who are soft on communism, and you end up with these labor mutations like Lane Kirkland or George Meany, who support Nixon's war in Indochina and denounce the anti-war movement, so that we lose the mechanism by which we can protect ourselves against the rapaciousness of the corporate state. And that, of course, is precisely what happened, beginning with the Taft-Hartley Act in 1948, which was the single most destructive piece of legislation to the American working class until Bill Clinton handed us NAFTA. There's no way to fight back, and you end up with these strange human formations like Clinton or Obama, who are self-identified as liberals, and yet have walked out on all of the core liberal values. And there's a front page story in today's New York Times about how Wall Street is on his knees before Wall Street, moving even closer to Wall Street. It's hard to imagine how much closer he could get. And under a Clinton administration, while they use the traditional language, that feel-your-pain language of traditional liberals, you get not only NAFTA, but the destruction of welfare, the deregulation of the FCC, which allows News Corp and Clear Channel to buy up all of our communications channels, the deregulation of the banking system. All of that comes out of a purportedly Democratic administration. And by the time Obama comes into office, what happens is that the destruction of international and domestic law put in place by the Bush administration is just codified by the Democrats. Obama can't even restore habeas corpus. The looting of the U.S. Treasury by Wall Street continues apace. There is no redress to the tremendous suffering of working men and women in this country, one in six of whom do not have a job. A million people a year are going bankrupt because they can't pay their medical bills, and premiums and co-payments are being jacked through the roof. 45,000 people a year in this country die because they can't pay their medical bills. Long-term unemployment, real unemployment figures, as the Los Angeles Times has pointed out, once you count people who are in low-wage jobs but are looking for full-time work, or people who have stopped looking for work, is somewhere between 17 and 20%. These are Depression-era figures. And they keep extending unemployment benefits because the Democrats destroyed welfare. Once the unemployment benefits end, and many of these workers are now months without a job, they'll have to survive courtesy of Bill Clinton on $143 a month. So there is no difference, on sort of social issues like abortion or gay rights, these kind of emotionally driven issues. You can, that's how they define difference. But on the systematic policies, whether it's the expanded reach of imperialism and preemptive war, the craven subservience on the part of all governmental institutions to the needs and interests of Wall Street, there is no difference. And that's very dangerous, because then that safety valve closes. And as you get, as we are getting, increased suffering, there's no way within the formal mechanisms of power for people to go. And so where do they go? They go to these fringe groups, like the Tea Party. And the rage of many people in these fringe groups, and you see it in these kind of lunatics that are being coughed up by the Republicans for a presidential candidate, they are very good at manipulating anger. And that anger is legitimate. And as long as the self-identified liberal class continues to speak in the dead language of policies and issues, that anger is going to be turned not only against the power elite, but against liberals who speak very hypocritically. Almost every value that a self-identified liberal would say that they purport to defend, from civil liberties to ending the war in Iraq and Afghanistan to alleviating the tremendous suffering of the poor and the working class, they turn around and support a political party, the Democrats, that makes a mockery of all of these values and do not have the spine or the courage to stand up for what it is they purport to believe. And I think this is largely because at this point the liberal class in the United States has not economically suffered the way the working class has. And I think that's part of the reason we can't get any traction on the anti-war movement, because liberals are universally despised by the underclass, as they should be. But the danger with that is that with that anger, not against liberals, comes also a kind of rejection of core liberal values. And that's really frightening, because then you begin to open the road for a kind of proto-fascism, which I think we are doing, especially as we play games with our currency. And I've lived through three currency collapses. And when the currency goes down, then all traditional systems of power are instantly delegitimized. And at that point, the game is up.
We're talking with Chris Hedges. His latest work is The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. And we will continue to explore the liberal class with him, what may be coming to America, what can be done, look at a bit of the Middle East, and his latest columns in Truthdig. Stay with us. This broadcast of The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Associated Black Charities. Associated Black Charities is a proud sponsor of the Black Male Identity Project. More information, www.morethan28days.com. That's morethan28days.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with Chris Hedges, who joins us today on The Mark Steiner Show. His latest book is The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. Chris, one of the things that as I read your work and I read your column in Truthdig and hear you on Amy's show, Democracy Now!, which the station carries as well, and on my friend Laura Flanders' show as well. So when I hear you, when I read you, and when people read and hear what you have to say, all joking, you know, it's a joke almost. So what do? Take a gun and shoot myself? I mean, it's what we face is very serious. And what America faces and the world faces is very serious. Whether it's what you write about population towards the end of your book, or what we see about the kind of power that can wrap itself around corporate America, wrapping its power around this country, which I think many people see. But then the question is, it has to be more than a lament. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, when you write that if people who love labor in 1994 should have walked away from the Democrats, but where do they go? You know, I mean, that the majority of people who put Barack Obama into office did it because they believed in a change. Do you know what I'm saying? It wasn't Barack Obama. He wasn't the question. Well, the question was, because he was African-American, putting the first black man in office meant a lot to a lot of people in a very visceral, emotional way.
Well, it's very effective branding. It's what Benetton and Calvin Klein did a few years ago, where they put people of color and HIV-positive models on their billboards. But, you know, 2 years of voting in the Senate, if you look at Obama's voting record, was abysmal. It was one corporate giveaway after another. I mean, I didn't support Hillary Clinton. I worked for Nader. But Clinton's voting record was better. And you got to turn off the TV and stop listening to the smoke machine. And, you know, they're very good. They're very good. This is a culture utterly awash in lies. And they know how to make us confused how we are made to feel with knowledge. And that's what the Obama administration did brilliantly, which is why advertising ages gave Obama their top annual award after the election, which was Marketer of the Year. And he beat Nike, Apple, and Zappos, because the professionals knew precisely what he had done. In the short term, you know, standing up and give you an Oprah-like talk about how we're going to take power back to the people, and that works. I mean, people feel really good, mm-hmm. but it's a lie. And I think it's better to bite the bullet. It's harder at first.
But what is the bullet we're biting, you think?
Recognize that both on the environmental and the economic front, these corporate forces are killing us. They are reconfiguring American society into a form of neo-feudalism. And they refuse, because of profit, to wean us away from our dependence on fossil fuels. And we have, at best, a decade left. We've already started. Global warming's already begun. We are almost at 400 parts per million, and human life, as we have sustained it, is about 350 parts per million. That's going to rise. Even if we stopped emitting all carbon emissions today, it still will rise somewhere around 500 parts per million. We're seeing the freak weather patterns, the droughts, the flooding. We're already seeing it. Nobody puts the pieces together because, of course, it's not convenient for a corporate media to do that. And my fear is that by the time people wake up, it's too late. We just don't have much time left. The Wall Street is once again playing their speculative game. They think that the U.S. government can come in and bail them out again. We have racked up the largest deficits because of this in human history, $12.8 trillion, which, frankly, as Andrew Bacevich and others point out, we can never repay. We are monetizing our debt, which is just a fancy way of saying that we are printing $600 billion worth of new money with nothing to back it up. Now, maybe they're right. I mean, we are the reserve currency of the world, and as long as we are the reserve currency, maybe they can get away with it. But everybody, all economists, even those who support the measures being instituted by the Fed, do agree that, first of all, it's a Hail Mary, but second of all, that if it doesn't work, it is catastrophic. And I don't think because we have confronted the structural failings, i.e. the idea that we can continue to borrow to maintain both an empire and a level of consumption we can no longer afford, because we've not confronted that reality, we're finished. At some point, that kind of borrowing has to stop. It's not sustainable over the long term, and nobody wants to address that point. So it's getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And the inability to confront reality, the illusion, and I don't want to keep plugging all my own books, but I wrote this book called Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, The Triumph of Spectacle, which is all about the illusions that grip American society, and I think we're the most illusioned nation on the planet, goes like this. We can have everything we want. Reality is never an impediment to what we desire. If we dig deep enough within ourselves, if we focus on happiness, if we grasp that we are truly exceptional, if we have faith that Jesus can carry out miracles, then we can be and have everything we want. And that's magical thinking. But it's fed to us across the political and cultural spectrum, whether it's Oprah, whether it's Tony Robbins and self-help gurus, whether it's Hollywood, whether it's positive psychologists, it's all there. And the danger is that, when you live within an illusion, you strive towards a dream, but you live within an illusion. And when you live within an illusion, you perpetuate a kind of infantilism. You never grow up. But the danger with that is that as the gap opens up between the illusion of who we think we are and where we're going and the reality, when it's our home that is foreclosed or repossessed, when we go bankrupt because we can't pay our medical bills, when we finally grasp that job that we lost, or maybe our father lost, $50 an hour in a steel mill with benefits and health insurance and a pension plan, the ability to actually raise a family on a single income is gone, and not coming back, and not only not coming back for us, but for our children, then we react like children, which is to scream for a demagogue, a savior, revenge, moral renewal. I watched it in Yugoslavia. I've read about it in Weimar. We're not immune from that. And that is precisely the process that's underway. And waking up and facing the nightmare in front of us, while unpleasant and difficult and depressing, and I can't deny that it's depressing. I have a three-year-old, and I see him reading one of his favorite books, this big picture book on sea aquatic sea life. And I look at him reading it, and I think, you know, unless we take radical measures now, every animal you look, every fish you see in that book will not exist in your lifetime. That's what we're facing. And the inability to confront the crisis, while it may make us feel better in the short term, ensures self-annihilation. And I think that, you know, those hard truths, while unpleasant, facing them actually begins the possibility of hope, because it begins the possibility of radical change. As long as we continue to think that anyone in the power elite, including the Democratic Party, is going to step in and protect us, or rectify the disastrous policies that ensure the disintegration of the nation and the ecosystem that sustains human life, then we're finished.
I'm not laughing at what you said. I'm just laughing at when you say things like, then we're finished. The question is, then what do you do?
I mean, why civil disobedience.
Tell me what do you mean by that?
Getting arrested.
No, I know that. I understand what that means and what civil disobedience means, and you have this chapter of Gandhi, just talk about beyond what that means. I mean, you can have civil disobedience, get arrested, but we're talking, when you talk about the liberal class hasn't been affected monetarily or economically by the crisis. I think many have, and I think many,
but not to the extent of the working class. I mean, they're not spending, as the poorest Americans are, 35% of their income on food. They haven't gotten.
When you say the liberal class, you're talking about the punditry, the power in politics. You're not. There are
no.
Many...
I'm talking about the lawyers and the teachers and the, you know, those people, the self-identified liberal class, which has largely become divorced from the interests of the working class because it busied itself with multiculturalism and identity politics and inclusiveness and stuff which in and of itself isn't bad. But when it's divorced from the primacy of justice, it just becomes a form of narcissism. And that severance between, let's call them radical or liberal movements and the working class is what's done us in and allowed the working class to be decimated by purportedly liberal forces while we sat by and did nothing. And now, of course, the assault is underway against the middle class. The middle class is next. And what the oligarchic state will do is turn about two-thirds of the country into a population that exists on subsistence level. You'll have a thin managerial class, and then you'll have these CEOs at places like Goldman Sachs or Citibank that are making $900,000 an hour. It's just like Versailles or the Forbidden City, or we've seen these reconfigurations throughout human history. So we have to step outside the formal mechanisms of power. It's why I supported Nader in 2008, not because I thought he was going to win. I'm not that naive. Mm-hmm. I don't think he thought he was going to win. But we have to begin to make the power elite frightened of us instead of letting them continue to make us frightened of them. The only thing Barack Obama is going to offer us in the next election is fear. Fear of whatever mutation the Republican Party coughs up. And I'm sure it'll be pretty ugly. Mitt Romney, I suppose, looks good compared to the rest of them. A man who made his fortune throwing American workers out of work. But we have to begin to defy the Democrats because... and we have to begin to become visible and vocal in the streets, because otherwise there is no route towards real reform left. So I'm not even naive enough to tell you it's going to work, but that is the only route left.
So just to kind of step back for just a moment, because I really want to talk about this latest column I read of yours and put that into this configuration. But when you... defining the terms that you use for the broad mass of people who would listen to this program and also for other places that you are, when you talk about the liberal class, that there are many people who make their living, when you say teachers, when I think of teachers, I'm talking about public school teachers. I'm talking about people who are, to me, working class, people who may be married to a truck driver, could be married to a doctor, could be married to a plumber. These are people who are struggling to survive every day and may have these.
Yeah, no, I don't want to pretend that, and I live in the state of New Jersey, so I'm watching what Chris Christie making war on.
Right.
Teachers unions. I'm talking about people who come out, you know, have a kind of educational background and a kind of world view. And I think that it is fair to say that those self-identified liberals, and certainly I'm not in any way, you're very right, I mean, I'm terrified about what's happening to teachers unions. But these self-identified liberals still live in comparison to the blue-collar working class in a comfort that at this point has been denied to a disenfranchised working class. And I think Baltimore is a pretty good example
of
that.
It is. It's like Camden. They're the same thing.
Well, Camden's, you know, believe it or not, worse. I mean,
I know it's worse, but I mean, in terms of the dislocation, people being left behind, in terms of the struggle going on in this city, like in other cities around the country, where people are saying you have to have a different budget that takes care of people and not putting it all into police and fire.
Well, you know, it's appalling. I mean, I'm writing a book right now with Joe Sacco, this great graphic illustrator.
We've interviewed him before. He's a wonderful guy. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's illustrating it, and even at certain points in the book, drawing panels. But we're writing out of the worst pockets of poverty in the United States, Camden being the first chapter, the coal fields of southern West Virginia being the second, Pine Ridge, South Dakota being the third, and then the last chapter will be undocumented, non-unionized farm laborers. To say, look, you know, these are the sacrifice zones. These are the people and the communities, and these have been sacrificed for the core. But now, with no impediments to the corporate state, with the ideology that the dictates the needs of the marketplace will determine human behavior. These sacrifices are going to leach, zones are going to leach outwards across the United States. So what you see in southern West Virginia, or what you see in Camden, or what you see in Baltimore, is just going to be writ large against probably two-thirds of the population. So you better take a look now, because this is coming. And I think my frustration with self-identified liberals is that they've all put their heads in the sand. They refuse to look. Now they're aided by a corporate media.
Who are these self-identified liberals? Talk about who you're talking about. I want to be really clear about that.
Supporters of the Democratic Party, people who believe that Barack Obama or Nancy Pelosi or somehow the Democrats are going to make a serious attempt to address these issues. I mean, everybody who voted for the Democrats in 2006 over the issue of the Iraq War and then stood there passively as the Democratic Party not only continued to fund the war, but increased the troop levels in Iraq by 30,000. I mean, how many times do you have to be betrayed?
But those tens of millions of people, let's say, that you're talking about right now, regular working Americans, regular folks who are struggling every day to survive, they pull down that lever because it's the only lever they see. It's the only lever it's in front of people. So the question is, you know what I'm saying? I mean, there's also a kind of radical class around really lovely people like Ralph Nader and others, who I think is an incredible human being and a very powerful force. But nevertheless, there has to be a way to do that doesn't ridicule the tens of millions who do believe in a different kind of world, who are struggling to survive, but that's the lever they see. That's the lever they pull.
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Voting, as my friend Daniel Berrigan says, if voting was that effective, it would be illegal. voting is a very minor part of civic engagement.
No question about that.
And so to somehow say that it all comes down to the day you vote is, that's sort of what the power elite wants you to think, and then the rest of the time you remain passive. All of the correctives to American democracy have come through movements that never achieve formal political power.
Right.
Whether that's the Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, the labor movement, the civil rights movement.
The SNCC workers, whoever they were.
And I think that's the failure on the part of those of us who care about issues of justice and equality, is that we forgot that it's not our job. It's not our job to take power. It's our job to make people in power frightened of us. I've lived in France. It works really well. Sarkozy is a creep, but he's terrified of the French unions. And also, you know, the organized university students. And if he tried to get up and tell university students that they had to pay $50,000 a year to go to college, they'd shut the country down. And that's what we need. The last liberal president in this country was Richard Nixon, because he passed legislation, not because he was a liberal or wanted it, much of it written by Nader, the OSHA, the Mine and Safety Act, the Clean Water Act, but because he was still frightened of movements. My friend Ken Heckler, who was a congressman from West Virginia and a stalwart defender of the miners, of the coal miners, was trying to get a black lung provision pushed through Congress,
right,
so that miners who were coughing themselves to death could get benefits. And Nixon didn't want to sign it. And Heckler got up in Washington and said, if Nixon doesn't sign it, there'll be a nationwide coal strike tomorrow. And Heckler admitted that he wasn't sure he could pull it off. But Nixon pissed his pants and signed it. And that's how power works. I mean, Karl Popper writes about this in The Open Society and Its Enemies. He said, the question is not how do you get good people to rule. Most people attracted to power are at best mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. The question is, how do you make the power elite frightened of you, i.e. the citizen? And that's what we forgot, and that's what we have to, as quickly as we can, attempt to rebuild. That's what the sit-down strikers did. That's what the bonus marchers did. That's what the Wobblies and Big Bill Haywood did. That's what Mother Jones did. And that's why, starting in World War I, the power elite went after these people, because on the eve of World War I, they were running scared. Socialism was a powerful force in this country. Eugene Debs, even in 1920, in prison, sitting in a prison cell, courtesy of Woodrow Wilson, pulls a million votes. Fourth largest red publication in this country, Appeal to Reason, was a socialist journal. We don't even have the vocabulary anymore to describe what's happening to us. That's how effective these purges have been. The idea that figures like Warren Buffett or Donald Trump or anyone else has, you know, any kind of popular following, to me, is staggering. These people are the enemy. The power elite, as it has throughout history, does not have our interests. It's all about their interests of profit. I mean, these corporations and individuals only know one word, and that's more. And it's more at our expense. And if you doubt me, look at what they're doing to city budgets. Look at what they're doing to social welfare programs. Look at what they're doing to our educational system. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And we have to recapture this kind of radicalism if we have any hope it comes down to even survival.
So, and I would add to your list people like Fannie Lou Hamer and Bayard Rustin and people who made that movement happen. So the question is, and again, let me just go back to this as we kind of round out this conversation to where we're going with this. I mean, what I was trying to posit before to you, Chris Hedges, was that those tens of millions of people who voted for Barack Obama are those people. That's why they were there. I'm not saying that voting power is what does it. I'm saying that those people went out in droves from state to state because they believe in something, whether it was myth or not. That's what made a change. That's who those people are.
I think that I think you're right. I mean, I think that the desire for change is genuine. I think just people have not been able to articulate how that change is going to come about, and it's not going to come about by voting for Barack Obama, as he has amply demonstrated during his administration. I mean, his administration can't even find the wherewithal to restore habeas corpus. I think that, you know, the message of the Obama administration was suitably amorphous. It tugged on our emotions, not on our intellect. We are a culture utterly awash in lies. These people who manipulate these messages are extremely skillful. And I think we have to begin to stand fast around moral imperatives that will inevitably, and certainly at first, make us pariahs, make us a minority, make us ridiculed in the way that Nader was as obstructionist. But if we aren't willing to stand up and assert ourselves and hold fast around moral imperatives, even if we're the only one out there, then it's just
So, so many ways where I conclude this in the last minute and a half we have, because you said we've said a great deal. We literally have about a minute and a half. But I just want to talk, just give us a 30-second, a minute and a half to talk about your latest column, which I think ties into all of this, was that I read, which was about Fahad Hashimi, who most of us do not even know who it is.
Well, you know, I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, an Arabic speaker. So I have a particular sensitivity to what's being done to Muslim Americans, and certainly what's happening in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And and you know, it's a long story. It's called No Justice and Kafka's America, which if your listeners type it into Google, they can find it. But in essence, it's detailing what this Muslim activist, Fahad Hashimi, who had been at Brooklyn College, he was about to be charged, not for any crime, but the only crime they could get was that an acquaintance of his was taking ponchos and waterproof socks to purportedly Al-Qaeda fighters in Pakistan. It wasn't even him, and it stayed at his apartment in London where he was getting a graduate degree. But they were going to bring into court his speeches, so they tape-recorded and monitored his speeches. And he has views that I find unpalatable. He supports the resistance in Afghanistan. But that's not the point. The point is that in a civic democracy, he has a right to make these statements, and he has a right not to be expected to be put in prison because of them. And it is a way, because he's a Muslim and because he's a religious Muslim, we all turn away. But in moments of instability, which I think are coming, and domestic unrest, we have allowed the state to, and all of these measures are detailed in this story, to put in place draconian rules and conditions to essentially silence anybody who steps outside of the mainstream and challenges the official narrative, as he did. And he's now being held in the Supermax prison for 15 years. So, you know, if anyone thinks that the state intends to limit themselves to the persecution of Muslims, especially once instability begins, and I think if we don't change our course, it will. Then you don't know much about human history.
Chris Hedges, it has been great to talk to you. I look forward to doing it again, and I want to thank you so much for your time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.